Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. Do you remember the longest road trip you ever took? Well, mine was the first 4 months after graduating college, the summer of 1969, with my girlfriend in her VW bus, Cape Breton Island, Nova Scotia, to Key West, Florida. Key West to Tijuana. Tijuana to Vancouver, and back cross-country to Boston, about 10,000 miles. And that's not as long as the one taken by today's guest. Standing on the island off the Alaskan coast, Philip Caputo marveled that Inupiat Eskimo schoolchildren pledge allegiance to the same flag as the children of Cuban immigrants in Key West, 6,000 miles away. And he says a question began to take shape. How does the United States, peopled by every race on earth, remain united? And Caputo resolved to drive from the nation's southernmost point to the northernmost point reachable by road, talking to everyday Americans about their lives. 14 years later, nearing 70, Caputo, his wife, and their two dogs drove a truck and an Airstream trailer from Key West, Florida to Dead Horse, Alaska, covering 16,000 miles in total. They avoided interstates and invited conversations with Americans you meet when you avoid interstates. Somewhere in many of these conversations, Caputo would ask two questions. What holds a country as vast and diverse as the United States together? And was it holding together as well as it used to? Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Novelist and journalist Philip Caputo has written 15 books, including 2 memoirs, 5 books of general nonfiction, and 8 novels. His acclaimed memoir of Vietnam, A Rumor of War, is widely regarded as a classic in the literature of war. Caputo shared the Pulitzer Prize in 1972 for investigative reporting on vote fraud in Chicago, and he's contributed to magazines over the years as well. His latest book is The Longest Road, Overland from Key West to the Arctic Ocean in Search of What Holds America Together. Welcome to Free Forum, Philip Caputo.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Okay, so I shared a little bit about my long trip, which I must say was and still remains one of the most memorable experiences of my life. And yours is that on steroids.
Yeah.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people, Philip, behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So I've mentioned a few highlights, but can you briefly bring to life your path to the work that you find yourself doing today? And feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got to be brief about that. I would probably say that as far as a turning point in my life, without question, that the serving in the Vietnam War was. I've often said that it's as though I died and was reborn as someone else in Vietnam. And I had a compulsion, I would call it, almost a sense of a kind of obligation to write about that war, and I set out to do it, and it took me 9 years to complete A Rumor of War, my memoir about my experiences there. And probably from the time it was published until now, I set off on a course as a writer. As far as mentors go, I can think of several, but certainly an English professor that I had in college at Loyola University of Chicago named Stanley Clays was certainly one. Another would have been a supervisor or a boss. I don't know exactly what to call him, but he was a senior investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune named George Bliss, whom I worked under. And as far as writing fiction goes, I would have to say William Styron would be number one on my list.
As a just from reading his work or from actually having personal interaction?
From both.
Uh-huh.
I got to know him fairly well. I lived most of the year in Connecticut, and so did he, about an hour and a half from where I live. And also because I had begun reading him, I think way back in the early 60s.
And then had the chance to be a mentee. Let me ask you one thing. How did you end up in Vietnam? Some people enlisted, some people got a bad lottery number, some people, et cetera. And actually the question probably that's easier to answer for a lot of people is how did you stay out? But how did you end up in the military?
Well, at the time, I went on active duty in 1964, actually about 3 or 4 months before the Tonkin Gulf Resolution in August of 64. You know, and at that time, the draft was something every young man had to face, and you had a choice of do I wait till I get drafted or do I enlist? And I was in the Marine Corps, so I had enlisted. I volunteered.
And what I'm curious drove you to that at that point? As you say, if that's before the Gulf of Tonkin, it's not a big war yet for most Americans. What was it that at that point in your age, Phil Caputo, said, I want to be a Marine?
Oh, I think I was, drawn to the Marines' challenge, its image as an elite, as a force that sailed and fought all around the world. Although I didn't really expect to be fighting.
That's right. Okay. And, now that little parenthetical says a lot.
I had one uncle who was at Iwo Jima, another uncle who was at Tarawa, and a close friend of mine whose uncle, with whom I was close friends, was a Silver Star winner at Tarawa, and I was much taken with them as, to my mind, as heroic individuals, and I suppose I wanted to lead a sort of heroic and adventurous life. The usual things that I think tend to drive young men into the Marine Corps, Special Forces, or into something similar to that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's the voice of Philip Caputo. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. Caputo is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist whose first book, A Rumor of War, about his experiences in Vietnam, is considered a classic. We're going to talk most of the show about his latest book, The Longest Road, Overland in Search of America from Key West to the Arctic Ocean. And you can learn more at Philip Caputo, C-A-P-U-T-O, that's one word, philipcaputo.com. Now, you said that Rumor of War, your experiences that led to Rumor of War, your time in Vietnam was a turning point, and you felt the burning need to write about it. Were you a writer before you were a Marine?
Well, not in a professional sense. I had written for my high school newspaper and also for the for my college newspaper and for the college magazine. But I had not published any books or I hadn't published any fiction or even nonfiction for that matter, except for the newspaper.
And as an identity, did you think, you know, when I get out of here, I think I'm going to be a writer?
No, I don't even think that I thought that then. I knew that I felt this, as I say, this compulsion or sense of obligation. I'm really search for a word for it. to write about the war, but really what I wanted to be once I was out and I kind of got my head a little bit straight and was a journalist, a mm-hmm. newspaper man, as we used to call him in those days.
That was actually going to be my next question.
That's what I became. I worked for the Chicago Tribune and for nearly 10 years. And later on, I was a contributing editor and correspondent for Esquire magazine and the New York Times Sunday magazine, among many others.
Yeah. And you shared a Pulitzer in 73 or 72 for a Chicago Tribune series on vote fraud. Now, I have to ask you, despite all the GOP alarms about voter fraud, we're told it almost never happens. But in this case, it did.
Oh, well, back in those days with the Chicago Democratic machine that was run by boss Richard J. Daley, to say that it occurred is an understatement.
Yeah, I mean, this is what...
It was, let's say, rampant and flagrant.
And it seems to me, actually, it's that memory, that Chicago where, you know, vote early, vote often, and all of that is, I think, what keeps the GOP myth alive.
You know, I can't really comment on whether or not... I'll put it there. I can't comment on the GOP's collective mentality.
Sure.
on that. I really don't know.
I'm just talking
I
about the...
I do know that the Republicans often felt that, and I think with justification, that the 1960 election went to Kennedy mostly because Richard J. Daley delivered the vote for him, and a lot of those votes were fraudulent.
Right, and we're talking about the same mayor who's mayor when you do your investigative report. Why did you leave newspaper journalism? It's a lifestyle, it's a way of life, and you left it long before journalism left journalists, you know, as a business.
That's a nice way to put it. Yeah. Like most newspaper guys, you know, you always say that, I think there's a book in me. So I had written this book, A Rumor of War. In fact, while I was on a leave of absence from the paper, and I was still employed by them when it was published, and for about a year and a half or 2 years after it was published, I was a Moscow correspondent for them at that time. At any rate, I then felt, well, okay, I did a book, but that there was a novel in me, and I wanted to write this novel that was based on certain experiences I had had covering a war in Ethiopia. And it became a novel called Horn of Africa. I had hoped for another leave of absence, but it was not granted, and so... being then fairly young, confident, and maybe a little crazy, I said, "Well, then the hell with it, I quit." And I did. And that novel, like A Rumor of War, was pretty successful. And I ended up staying out of daily journalism. I have kept my hand in journalism, though, up until, well, I'd say even now.
Right. That's why I made the distinction of newspaper journalism, the daily
kind of the daily grind. No, I don't do that. I haven't done that for years, but I do a lot of magazine journalism.
Yeah. Were you surprised by the response to Rumor of War?
Oh, I was more than surprised. I was floored by it.
And just for people, I mean, it's sold 2 million, it's in many, many languages, and at that time, the two books, it's funny, that I remember are Your Rumor of War and Michael Hare's Dispatches as being the two that sort of stuck out at the time.
Yeah, well, I think they stuck out at the time because they were virtually about the only ones that came out. The Vietnam War was, at that time, was kind of anathema to most publishers. But I think Michael and I wrote about the war from the inside, you know, from proverbial belly of the beast, which had not been done before, and I think that that broke the ice.
Yeah, right.
I would add, too, is that Tim O'Brien's novel also came out almost at the exact same time, his novel Going After Cacciato.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and one thing I would say is that rather than being literary books where war is all sorts of things, metaphors and these sorts of things, you guys were talking about the experience on the ground.
Yes.
Yeah. You've also written for Hollywood, Philip Caputo. How did that happen, and We're in Los Angeles here. What was your experience like?
Well, to say that I wrote screenplays for Hollywood would be something of a stretch. I did some work on the screenplay for the CBS TV miniseries about A Rumor of War. I did some revisions of that. I wrote an ending for it, but that was more of a collaborative effort. The real brains behind the screenplay was John Sackrett Young, who later became the writer and the producer, director, and all-around major domo of China Beach.
Right.
And then I did some work for Paramount, working on screenplays that had already been written by other people. And I did do an original screenplay and a draft for Michael Douglas from my own book, Horn of Africa. And I think that probably pretty much sums up my my screenwriting.
And it was a mutual resume. Parting.
If somebody came up to me today and said, "Do you want to write a screenplay?" I'd say sure. You know, I mean, the money's great, and it's to tell you the truth, I don't want to sound glib about it, but it's a lot easier than writing novels or nonfiction books.
Interesting. One of the things, I've actually written screenplays myself, one of the things that I see is it has the clearest format, the clearest rules. You are writing within something, and limitations, I think, actually always help creativity.
Yeah, you know, I would agree with you on that, that sometimes I have, when I was working on those screenplays, and tell you the truth, is that sometimes when I'm working on a novel, I try to apply a little bit that I did learn from screenwriting to the novel, because I guess it's like writing poetry. Sometimes it's good to have a rhyme scheme.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it doesn't hurt to have something to wrangle your mind. When did you start writing fiction? It seems to me taking on any book, I'm going to write a book, is a serious choice. What drew you toward novels? Because that's what you've done the most of, isn't it, really?
I would say, not by a lot. But I've written more fiction than I have nonfiction insofar as books go. Certainly not if you count the magazine journalism, no. I think what drew me to it is that writing fiction is, I would say, almost immeasurably more difficult than writing nonfiction. But it is far more rewarding. And I also discovered that if there was some kind of psychological truth, some emotional truth that I wanted to dramatize, that having to stick within the, this is a case here, by the way, of the rules being an impediment, stick within the rules of journalism that I felt too confined, the broader liberties allowed by fiction attracted me.
Okay. I'm talking with Philip Caputo. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. Philip's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His first book, A Rumor of War, about his experiences in Vietnam, is considered a classic. And we're going to talk from here on about his latest book, The Longest Road, Overland in Search of America from Key West to the Arctic Ocean. And you can learn more at Philip Caputo, CAPUTO.com. So, you say that you envisioned the trip that you take in The Longest Road years before you took it seriously and acted on it. So tell us about that moment that I mentioned in the introduction of the original inspiration.
Yeah, I happen to have been on a combined hunting, fishing, river rafting journey in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in 1996, and after we were flown out of the wilderness, We landed on this island called Barter Island off the coast of Alaska, where we were to pick up another plane that would take us back to the mainland. While I was there hanging around waiting for the bush plane to come in, I just walked around this Eskimo settlement for a bit and came across the school. And, you know, the American flag was out there, and the kids pledged allegiance to that flag, and it occurred to me that only 6 months before that I had been down in Key West, Florida, where I had lived, by the way, for about 11 years, and I had been visiting some of my old haunts. And I said, my God, I said, those Cuban kids, the kids of Cuban immigrants down there, pledge allegiance to the same flag, and that's only 90 miles from Havana, and here I am only a little over 1,000 miles south of the North Pole, and it's the same flag, the same country. And we have Eskimos here, kids of Cuban immigrants down there, and then every other kind of race and ethnicity and religion in between. And it just amazed me that a place so huge, the distance, you know, from Key West to Barter Island was equivalent to the distance from Moscow to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And again, so diverse, so vast, and yet it all hung together somehow. And I just marveled at that. And I thought to myself then, I said, wouldn't it be something to be able to drive from the southernmost point at Key West all the way to the northernmost point that you can get to by road, which is Dead Horse, Alaska? You couldn't drive to Barter Island, nor could you drive to the actual geographical northernmost point, which is Point Barrow. But you can drive to Dead Horse, Alaska, which is only about 100 miles south and a little bit west of Point Barrow. I said, wouldn't that be something to do that and just, I don't know, talk to people along the way? And it just went dormant on me for many years later until I was facing my 70th birthday. My 94-year-old father died, got me to thinking about, you know, issues of mortality, as well as my own age, and that just, it just sprang back into my mind, and I thought, I said, well, if I'm going to do that journey, I probably ought to do it now. Wait too long, because time is running out. And at the same time, especially looking at the 2010 elections, and really and at our political picture right now, it did seem that the country was not hanging together anywhere near as well as it once had. It seemed to be like there were apparent rips in the social fabric that didn't exist, say, in 1996.
Yeah, I was thinking, Philip, of 96, you know, that we had the impeachment proceedings against Clinton, which you know, are a harbinger kind of what goes on later. But for the most part, yeah, it seems that it's very different. You actually write. You say, I'm going to read a full quote here. 14 years earlier, standing in front of the school, I'd asked, what held this nation together? What made the pluribus unum? And for anyone who doesn't know that Latin, it's of many one. And I like that. What made the pluribus unum? Now I revise the question. Would it continue to hold together? Because the America of 2010 wasn't the America of 1996. I'd been living in it the whole time, but sometimes didn't recognize it. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, it's the experiences, I think, that we've all had, either actually in person or by simply watching the news or reading the news. There seemed to be such tension in the political fabric, I should say tension tearing at the political fabric and also the social fabric. And I believe, I'm virtually convinced, that the onset of the Great Recession really aggravated those forces. It seemed to me that America, that the conceit that the media used, red states, blue states, red America, blue America, was more than just a conceit, that the population did seem to be dividing itself into these camps, which were talking right through and past each other, or at each other, but not to each other. Well, it was like to a point where at one point before I started the journey, I actually had, by the way, a pre-journey, but I won't go into that, where I had to deliver a trailer to a farm in Florida. And as I was driving back home to Connecticut, I passed Charleston, South Carolina, on the very day of the 150th anniversary of the firing on Fort Sumter. And Charleston was getting ready to celebrate that particular event. And there was an argument on a talk radio show to the item where people were arguing about states' rights and whether the war was fought for to eradicate slavery or for states' rights. And one gentleman who probably was African-American got on and objected to the fact that a lot of white Charlestonians had staged a secessionist ball back in December to mark South Carolina's secession from the Union, and I was sort of stunned by that.
Yeah.
Didn't we get these issues settled with about 125 years ago, and they still seem to be to have the power to arouse very strong emotions.
Yeah. Well, one of my theories, and I'm not the only one that holds it, is that the resentments of the South have been transferred, whether transferred from race to homosexuality to abortion to whatever intellectual elites, etc. But that the red states are basically the Confederacy, and the resentments and so on seem to me to be just as alive in a 2004-2008 election as they were back then, just with different targets.
Yeah, well, but I'd have to disagree with you about one thing, Terrence, is that the red states are by no means only the states of the old Confederacy. Nebraska, Kansas,
true.
Idaho, Montana, well, maybe not Montana so much, but some of the parts of the Dakotas, a lot of them are just as red in the modern sense of the term,
yeah.
by the way,
yeah.
not communist.
Yeah, you know,
as are the states of the old Confederacy.
True, true. You know, one thing I just noticed when you mentioned hearing that talk radio segment on your earlier drive, you don't mention talk radio much. If hardly at all. In this book, and my experience when I'm out between cities is that I end up listening to a lot of AM radio, and I end up, you know, having a different, you know, I get much more of a taste of that than I do most other times. Did you listen to it? Did you choose to leave it out of the book? You get where I'm going.
No, I did not listen to it.
Aha! Uh-huh.
In the entire 4 months that we were on this journey, we watched television for approximately 10 minutes, and as far as listening to the radio, was that we almost confined ourselves strictly to every now and then picking up the headlines or what weather, more importantly,
mm-hmm,
what
mm-hmm,
weather conditions
mm-hmm.
were like. And I did that, not, you know.
That's a choice.
Partly to escape
yeah.
All of this noise, but partly because I wanted to talk to people. And I wanted them to give me their unvarnished feelings and opinions about the state of the country and their own lives. And I wanted to have a kind of unvarnished mind when
mm-hmm.
I listened to them.
Sure, that makes sense. That's a clear choice. We're at about the halfway point. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Philip Caputo, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, whose first book, A Rumor of War, about his experiences in Vietnam, is a classic. And we're talking now about his latest book, The Longest Road, Overland in Search of America, from Key West to the Arctic Ocean. You can learn more at philipcaputo.com. That's C-A-P-U-T-O, philipcaputo, one word, .com. One little incident. You just said, we, in our trip, you originally were going to go solo, and you changed your mind. What happened?
Oh, I came to the realization that I probably, at 70 years old, towing a trailer with two dogs, first of all, would have been too much, you know, for me. So that's my practical reason. The romantic reason is I didn't want to be away from my wife for that long. And she didn't want me to be away either, and she has an adventurous temperament herself, and she was dying to go on to go with me on this, and I certainly couldn't turn her down.
One thing I thought was that the experience is so different. One is solo and it's separation from relationship. The other one is more constantly together than probably ever in your lives.
We were. I think it was a period of call it intense togetherness, and overall we had a couple of quarrels along the way, but they weren't very serious, and we ended up the trip probably closer than we had been before. As I've phrased it in the book, we became road buddies.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people thought that, and a lot of people even now say that, oh, if my wife and I would kill each other, or we wouldn't be able to get along for more than 2 or 3 days. But we got along overall pretty darn well.
Yeah. The question that you asked, and you then changed it to two questions, what holds America together, and is it holding together as well as it used to? When did you, in the course of this, approach a publisher and say, I'm going to take this trip, I'm going to ask these questions? That's my first question. And two, did anybody, publishers, editors, anybody else weigh in and have other ideas for you?
No, I approached the publisher at almost the very beginning, no, I don't think they had. Any other suggestions as to a purpose for the journey. And as I thought I made clear. By the way, there's several reviews that I've seen, more customer reviews in Amazon, where people seem to feel disappointed that I don't answer that question myself, that I don't come to some conclusion. But, you know, the real purpose of this journey was to, A, just to do it.
Yeah.
And B, was to find out what people's lives were like. And among those to whom I did address that question, what they thought about, what their answers were, I should say. And I just wanted to play the part of the reporter, and report what their opinions were and what their views were, as well as try to get some idea of what their lives were like, wherever I might have encountered them. But no, nobody had any alternative ideas.
And having taken the trip and had those conversations and asked that question, is that if you were to do it again, is that the question you'd ask?
Yeah, I think I would certainly still ask that question. I think, though, were I to do it again, I might put more emphasis on eliciting their opinions about why, if they think we're getting unstuck as a society, and if so, why they think so?
Yeah,
I wasn't. When I look back on it, I don't think I was quite as aggressive about that question as I probably could have been.
Yeah, in other words, that's my take. Certainly from the book, I get much more of a sense of their answer to question one, what holds us together, than the other question, and both to me are very interesting. One of the points I made was you avoided interstates, and so you met, and the conversations you had were people who were not on interstates. In fact, to some extent, people who you'd find at campgrounds where you could fit an Airstream and so on. So it was you knew that by doing that you were choosing a different a subset of America.
Yeah, in a way, I don't know about subset though. And the other thing was is that most of the people that I spoke to and interviewed were not those whom I encountered in
the campgrounds. But it does, I mean, it does come up.
It was
now
mostly the people in the towns,
in the diners
along the way.
Yeah.
And you know, it was just a wide, wide range of people. I mean, there was a couple in Florida who, get this, had walked to Florida from West Virginia because they had felt a religious call to administer to the to drug addicts and alcoholics, really interesting couple who had done something I'd never heard of anybody doing, and you know, I found an old hippie commune back in the backwoods of Tennessee.
The farm, Stephen Gaskin's farm.
Yeah, right. And it was allegedly sort of like the hippie commune of America.
Certainly in terms of lasting. I remember reading a book by him probably in 70, 71, something like that.
Yeah. He started it, I think, in 70.
Yeah.
And then there was a farm woman in Missouri who had saved her farm and indeed the entire valley she lived in from a really crazy federal dam project. And the farm that she lived on had been in her family since President James Madison's administration. Then I would say that maybe one of the most fascinating and captivating, really, not fascinating, captivating characters I met was named Ansel Woodenknife.
I knew that's who you were going to say. By the way, my next question, Philip, was going to be, who were the three or four characters that stand out the most? But you went there yourself. Tell us about Woodenknife.
Yeah. Well, Ansel was a... I think he's about 54 years old. He is an entrepreneur who perfected a food, a dish, called the Indian taco. It's basically your Mexican-style taco, but made with Indian fry bread. And he ran an extremely successful cafe and restaurant, serving this and other Native American dishes. And then became a wholesaler, and he sells Indian tacos and other Native American herbs, spices, and so forth to supermarket chains all over the country. He was named the Small Business Man of the Year in South Dakota. He was appointed to the Tourist Board by the governor of South Dakota. But this man never got past the ninth grade. He was brought up one of 12 children in a log cabin with no electricity and no running water on the Rosebud Indian Reservation. And then, at the age of 10, was plucked off that reservation against his parents' wishes by a government program that was trying to almost say force assimilation on Native Americans, in effect, to turn them into white people, was sent to live with a family in Philadelphia. But he ran away. He said he liked his family, but it wasn't my family. And he kept running away until he got sent back to the reservation as a quote-unquote incorrigible. And he had a chip on his shoulder, and he got in a lot of fights and a lot of trouble and all that, but finally straightened himself out and became the success he is now. But the thing that really fascinated me was that his experience of this forced assimilation ended up compelling him to look deeper into his own roots, his own cultural roots, as an Ogallala Lakota. Or Ogallala Sioux, as we would say. And he eventually became a Lakota sun dancer, which is, in effect, a Lakota shaman.
And tell people that this is
a difficult trial that you have to go through. And anyway, this guy was one of the wisest men I'd ever met, and one of the most serene, I would have to say.
And, yeah, I remember he is the character that sticks out for me the most, too, that you met along the way, because he bridges so many cultures. I mean, just to be a shaman and an entrepreneur is one thing, and then he knows what it is to be a white person, having lived, and he knows what it is, just a remarkable person. What were some of the things you gleaned from him, not just in answer to your one question about what holds us together, but he had a lot to say.
He did. Well, I think that one of the things I did take away from him, I just mentioned it, is the man's serenity. I've met very few people who are that comfortable in their own skin as he was. And this is what has allowed him, as he put it, to walk in two worlds. He said it's a very difficult world, a walk that he does. But he is able to do it. I mean, he mentors to his fellow Lakotas, especially the young ones, because as I point out in the book, the conditions on that reservation, the Pine Ridge Reservation, are utterly dreadful. And at the same time, he is able to maintain his business with as much efficiency, I think, as any other businessman would, and as much success. I didn't fully agree with him on this, but I was fascinated by it. He kind of thought that that what all of we Americans should do is whatever race or ethnicity we come from, is that we should get back in touch with our roots, but never surrender our American identity. And then he used a rather beautiful phrase, is he said then, he said the United States would not be a melting pot, he said, but a blanket of color all sewn into the shape of the American flag. And I think that's what sticks in my mind from him.
Yeah, no, one thing, I'm quoting him, one of the most valuable things about this country is learning different cultures. That's the most colorful fabric I've encountered in life. And then he follows that by saying, I don't go up to people in fear. And one other thing he says here is, he says, we all believe in this country that we're people who are free to be people. You get that and you don't have to fear anybody anymore. You know, I've never lost the fact that I'm a free person. The government may hate me because I'm an Indian, but my ancestors walked freely. And by God, if it kills me, I'll walk freely too. Interesting for me when he said the government may hate me. That stuck out for me because, as you pointed out, everything else was so serene.
And even I can recall when he said that. He said that in a very level voice. There was no anger or rage in his voice or even in his manner when he said that. But he probably feels it down in his marrow. I imagine that experience of... I didn't go into it in detail, but two agents from the Bureau of Indian Affairs just showed up at his school and, you know, said, you've been selected, so to speak, and put him in a van and drove him to the airport in Pierre, South Dakota, and escorted him all the way to Philadelphia. And all of a sudden he finds himself with an Italian-American family in Philadelphia, and he had, you know, given his... a rather parochial life that he'd been leading in the Rosebud Reservation. He probably had no idea where the hell Pennsylvania was.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I don't think I was fully aware of that experience. I've read about South Africa doing that. Remember?
Yeah, Australia did it too.
Yeah.
With Aboriginals.
And I didn't know.
I knew that the United States had done that, and I thought that sort of program
was hundreds of years ago or 100 years ago.
Well, I think was abandoned about 100 years ago, but a version of it did come back to life, and because it wasn't just Indian children, it was also Indian adults, attempts to urbanize them in other words, the idea was is that there's so many pathologies, and there are, on reservations, that by getting them off the reservations and integrated more in mainstream culture would benefit Native Americans. And children were not exempt from this program, and it was in effect till 1977.
Amazing. Amazing. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Philip Caputo, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. We're talking about his book, The Longest Road, Overland in Search of America from Key West to the Arctic Ocean. He and his wife and two dogs took that trip from Key West to Dead Horse, Alaska. And along the way, he chatted with Americans, avoiding interstates. So chatted with the Americans you find when you avoid interstates and just asked them, how was America holding together, and what held it together? You can learn more at Philip Caputo, CAPUTO.com. What surprised you the most?
Good question. Surprise is the word, but mm-hmm.
What did you discover?
When I began the trip, I would call myself cautiously pessimistic about the state of the country, both socially and economically. But I finished cautiously optimistic because virtually everybody that we met along the way, and I think I interviewed 83 people altogether, some of them for hours and hours. Not all 83 interviews appear in the book,
sure.
but at least half of them do. And the Americans that I met and that I spoke to were far more sensible and level-headed and calm in voicing their opinions and their viewpoints, then one would be led to believe if you just confine yourself to the news on TV or in the newspapers or online. And even though it was mostly a red state trip, and even though my own politics are pretty much lefty, so I met a lot of people with whom I would have political disagreements or disagreements about the economy or other issues. But in general, we never, ever got into shouting matches or there was never any bitter feelings. And I came away feeling that somehow or another, if people, let's say, who think like I do and these people that I met along the way, if we could just get together and kind of hash out our own issues, that the country would be run a lot better than it is now by the people that we're electing. Now, that's something of an anomaly, because these people who are digging their heels in jumping into their ideological bunkers, never to be removed, in Washington, have been elected probably by the very people I was talking to. So I haven't been able to resolve that.
That was, of course, going to be my question, is sort of, yeah. What then, Philip?
I don't know. this book was mainly a travel adventure memoir. It's by no means any kind of political or social treatise, and I am by no means a deep political thinker, so I really can't answer that.
Well, let me ask, and I'm going to push you a little bit in
sure.
that, just because you did spend this many months, a year, 18 months ago, whatever it was, albeit that, but you did spend this many months pondering these questions, asking these questions. I can imagine you and Leslie, after a conversation, sort of tossing things back and forth. So you were intent on this at a time when the evidence is known to so many people. And I'll use, an expression that's come to that the 1% is controlling government to their benefit, and that the 99% are not getting a fair deal, isn't there some denial in so many optimistic answers that we're hanging together? I mean, at some level, we're not.
Well, yes, I would say that objectively speaking, we're not. And I would say that a lot of the divisiveness, if not most of it, in the country today, is caused by this ever-widening gap between the super-rich and the rest of us. You would probably find that a lot of the anger that you hear expressed, again, in the media and in the newspapers, or in the media in general, whether it's right-wing populism or left-wing populism, that is to say, let's say, Occupy Wall Street versus the Tea Party.
Sure.
I think you would find that one thing that a lot of them have in common is the feeling that the ordinary or the common man and the common woman are being left out of the political process, that their opportunities economically are shrinking, that the chance for advancement into the middle class, if you're not middle class, or your ability to hang on to your middle class status, if you already are, is being diminished. Now, I think that a lot of that, you would probably find that these Tea Party people and these Occupy Wall Street people would have more in common that way. And I've noticed that there's been some slight fusion of the two in certain libertarian politicians, like Rand Paul, for example.
On certain issues, yeah.
Yeah, on certain issues. I mean, I'm not saying that these guys are all going to get together and hug and kiss, because they probably won't. but I think there is this sense, and I'm really now extrapolating. That has nothing.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm asking you to do.
But it's something that I feel myself is that there are these huge power structures that, yes, there is too much big government, as the Tea Party people say, and yes, there is too much power in big money, or the financial institutions or corporate power, as the Occupy Wall Street people say, and it is this alliance between big government and big money, I'll call it, that I think is making America not the country that I grew up in. I'm the son of a machinist, and a woman who never worked really at a full-time job, and who bagged groceries every now and then in a supermarket, but was basically a stay-at-home milk and cookies mom. And my dad, on a machinist salary, was able to send two kids to college.
Yeah.
And, you know, he and I once, before he died, he and I once figured out what a machinist would have to make to do that today, and it came to something like $175,000 a year.
And would the students end up with huge loans or not?
You mean,
because when you and I went to college, you didn't end up with these massive loans.
No,
even
no,
if you took
you,
them.
No, you did not. No, you and yeah. you and I are about the same generation, and yeah. No, you didn't. I was able to supplement what my father could come across with by working summer jobs in construction and landscape crews and stuff like that.
I think I ended up.
I graduated college without owing a dime to anybody.
I owned about four. I owed about $4,000, $5,000.
Yeah.
And yeah. Okay. I think we're going to leave it at that. But I can tell, actually, and I want to read. I will read just a couple of things. At the end, you ask yourself if you had to say, and one thing you say is, I threw out the idea that America's binding force was its unboundedness. You could travel across every state line on the map and never have to show a passport, and knowing you had the freedom to go just where you pleased, even if you never went anywhere, liberated your mind to think as it pleased. And then you said, anytime somebody has to shift position just because of you, you've come into more than that person's face because you've taken their freedom and exchanged it for something you probably don't even value. There's a lot more to this country than the next toy. I wanted to push you a little bit into that, but I'm going to leave with one final thing, and you don't have time for response, but Rebecca Solnit has a wonderful book called Paradise in a Place Called Hell. And what it points out is that when people experience the earthquake of 06 in San Francisco or Katrina, or she looks at six of these natural disasters, they band together. They join together across all differences. And what's so unfortunate right now is that in the face of the economic issues that we all face, we're not as able to do that as easily as we are with a natural disaster. We are manipulatable and manipulated, and I think that's a conundrum we've got to solve.
I agree. Yeah, I remember reading about that idea in her book. Yeah.
So again, this book is The Longest Road, Overland in Search of America from Key West to the Arctic Ocean, and the website is philipcaputo.com. That's C-A-P-U-T-O. Thank you, Philip Caputo. Keep up the good work. Stay on the line. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. TerrenceMcnally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to get my weekly email announcement, we'll tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about in four or five articles of background, sign up at my site or email me at TEMcNally, TEMcnally, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the free forum podcast on iTunes. This program is going to be archived for the next 90 days at kpfk.org. Check audio archive, scroll down by date and time. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners, I look forward to being with you again next week